Wind it up, baby. Oh, shake it to your daddy. I'm gonna ride that train tonight. Goodbye. Big eight wheel rolling down the track. Me, your true loving daddy ain't gonna come back. I wanna move. I got the move. Well, don't you hesitate when I motivate. I wanna move on. One of these days, son, it won't be long. You're gonna look for Matt Lucas. Matt Lucas be gone. I wanna move. I got the move. You find much too high when you give him the eye. I wanna move on. I got the move. I wanna move, baby, move it on down the line. I got the move. Wah-boo. Yeah, move. I'm on a move. Rub it back, pretty baby. I'm on my way. I'm gonna move on. Engineer, take a throttle in hand. And won't you move me right down to that good loving land? I'm on a move. I got to move. Well, I'm on my way. I'm going home to stay. I'm gonna move on. I'm on a move. I'm on a move. Get rid of these blues. You find much too high when you gave him the eye. I wanna move on. I got the move. Baby, baby. You find much too high when you gave him the eye. I wanna move. Well, don't you hesitate. I'm on a murder raid. I gotta move on. Well, get yourself under control. I got to go. I wanna move on. Goodbye, baby.
I'd like you to welcome Mr. Matt Lucas to Blue Power. This is the Blue Power Hour coming to you live from Van Nuys, California. And the date today is October the 6th, 2002. Mr. Matt Lucas, how are you, pal?
Wind it up, baby.
Wind it up, baby.
Yeah.
It's been a long time, Matt.
It sure has. I think last time was back in 88.
88. Last time that I saw you, you pulled up beside my house in a, I think it was a big motorhome, was it?
Yeah, I had an Airstream and a red Cadillac.
Absolutely. And didn't you have a motorcycle, too?
Yeah, I had a motorcycle.
What kind of, was it a Harley?
No, it was a Yamaha.
Yamaha, yeah. Yamaha. You were riding it around. Matt is here in the studio with us this evening with his beautiful wife, Barbara. And we just went out and had Chinese food.
Man, it was good.
It was really good. We went to Uncle Chen.
Yeah, Kaisamoka Bundae.
Kaisamoka Bulae.
All right.
I went to Chinatown. Tonight, we're going to talk to Mr. Matt Lucas about his career and where he is from. And we, of course, we want to talk to him about that first record that we played, Moving On. That was on Smash Records. What, 1961, was it?
I think recorded in 1962, and it charted in Billboard 62 and 63. And it started off on a small label that Roland James had in Memphis. He owned a studio called Sonic Studio out on Madison. I think it was 1692 Madison. And
what was the name of that label?
Rene? It was Rene, that's right. Yeah, you can tell I've been up a while.
Yeah, it was Rene Records, and then Smash Records, Mercury.
Yeah, they took the record over and leased it from Rene, and it actually didn't take me out of the hills and put me on the pills, because I think I was taking those pills before the record.
Oh, man, come on. You weren't taking pills and doing booze, were you, buddy?
Well, I tell you, man.
Anything to take off the weight, take off the stress.
Yeah, I had a little trouble getting diet pills back then in 62 because I only weighed about 130 pounds.
Catch any truck driver, right?
Yeah.
Any truck driver. Who was on that session with you?
Well, I was playing drums and singing. There was no dubbing in. And an excellent bass player by the name of J.W. Grubbs. He's gone now. And one of my dearest friends, Norval Feltz, was playing lead guitar.
My goodness. I heard you mention Narvel Felt so many times.
Yeah.
And I never met him.
Let
one
me
of
tell
these
you,
days.
He's just one of the nicest, most honest guys in the world. I don't know what he's doing in this business. He's so nice.
Well, we need good guys in this business.
We do.
We really need good guys in this business. They're hard to find. So you, what happened? I mean, where? First, tell us where you come from originally.
I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, July the 19th, 1935. And I was adopted from the Tennessee Children's Society. And I was adopted by a very nice couple, Lauren and Effie Lucas, and I took their name, and they lived in a little town that I hated called Poplar Bluff, Missouri. And my dad had what they called back then a picture show. He had two picture shows, the Criterion and the Rogers Theater. And so I got in the movies free, and I would sit in the movie and I'd watch all those great MGM musicals and all the Warner Brothers musicals and the great musicals. And then, of course, my parents took me to church all the time and took me to Vacation Bible School. And so I grew up in music and the arts.
How did you come to the drums?
The drums I always wanted to play. I used to beat on pots and pans and drive my folks crazy. And the grade school that I went to, I was in, it was called Mark Twain, was the name of the school. And I played in the Mark Twain Rhythm Band. And I played claves, maracas, and tambourine. And I always love rhythm. To me, and it's the same today, if it doesn't have the beat, it has nothing.
Ain't it the truth?
Yes.
It was like when I first came to America and I dropped that nickel into my daddy's Wurlitzer in 1947, and I heard Louis Jordan.
Oh, boy.
Oh, I couldn't believe it. I mean, Louis Jordan and Jack McVeigh and the big backbeat.
Yeah.
I said, man,
yeah.
This is it. This is what I like.
The Timpani Five.
Yeah. The Timpani Five, you're right.
Yeah.
Louis Jordan, the Timpani Five. I played a lot of Louis Jordan on the show. It was his birthday a couple months back. So you went through high school and you started playing with bands. You put your own band together?
Well, no, I started off, I tried to get some jobs with some hillbilly bands, but the hillbilly bands didn't like me because they didn't like drums. And no one wanted drums with a hillbilly band. But I love jazz, I love the blues, and I started playing with what they call hotel bands. And there was a band called the Ray Chilton Orchestra, and had five saxophones, piano, upright bass, and drums. The Chilton Band was a family band. There was four family members in that band, and they would work like what used to be called, hotel gigs or Mickey Mouse bands is what they called it actually at the time. And sometimes the drummer, Bill Chilton, would get so drunk he'd fall off the drums and they would ask me to take his place.
And you sat in?
I sat in and started off with brushes, and then some songs, of course, I'd play sticks on, but we were doing all the old standards and doing a lot of Duke Ellington and songs that were popular of the
yeah.
day.
Well, I tell you what, I started out as a drummer,
mm-hmm.
but I found out one thing.
Yeah?
They were
that?
Too hard to run with. I was a terrible drummer. I loved the drums, too, because I used to sit and listen to, I had an album that came on, it was on Capitol Records, I think, came out in 50 sometime, called Big Band Drums, I think it was, something like, Hi-Fi Drums, it was called.
Oh, boy.
Hi-Fi
yeah.
drums, and it had Buddy Rich, mm-hmm. Gene Krupa, Louis Belson,
mm-hmm.
Art Blakey, Stanley Black, had a whole bunch of great drummers, but all these big band charts, I mean,
right.
really kick-ass
yeah.
big band charts, you
yeah.
know, and I used to sit, and I had I'd get the ironing board
uh-huh.
in the back with my sticks, man, and I would, like, practice my rudiments and stuff like that.
Man, what a great practice pad that would be.
Oh, it was a great practice pad. Yeah. And I had this old Slingerland set, you know, with a 32-inch bass drum and wooden shells and no cases, so I had to carry everything to the gig, and it was just impossible. And I finally figured out, well, this is just too much, and I wasn't that good at it, and I decided I wanted to play piano or guitar. Yeah. And I started going toward the guitar. I like that.
Well, boy, I think my idol, of course, as far as drums went back then, was Gene Krupa. I loved his showmanship, and Gene has to be congratulated because of bringing the drums out in front of the band. And his showmanship was outstanding, of course, with Benny Goodman, and then later Lionel Hampton, and then the Gene Krupa Orchestra. And I got to meet Gene Krupa once. I ran away from home, which I did a lot of. Like I said, I didn't care too much for that little town of Poplar Bluff because I was always getting in trouble hanging out on, let's say, the other side of the tracks. They didn't call it the other side of the tracks. Actually, they call it the holler. But I would I went up to see my idol, Gene Krupa, and I went 150 miles away from home, and he was playing at the Park Plaza Hotel in St. Louis. There was Teddy Wilson on piano and Eddie Hsu on tenor sax, and I hid behind a column in the basement of that hotel where the lounge was, where they were playing, and I couldn't believe it, but Gene Krupa was setting up his own drums, and it was pretty obvious that I was probably hiding, so Gene Krupa came over to me behind the column and grabbed me, and he said, "Son, how you doing?" I almost fainted, man. I thought, wow, Gene Krupa. He said, "You want to be a drummer?" I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Well, it's nice to have you. I'm glad you to shake your hand. And if you ever buy a new set of drums, get yourself a Gene Krupa Slingerland set." And you know something? The very first set of drums that I bought was the Gene Krupa One End Ensemble. Yeah.
My God. And I mean, to talk about promoting, huh?
Yeah, and that was in St. Louis.
But just to shake his hand, I mean, that was like, that must have been something.
Yeah, of course, I was a fan of Teddy Wilson and Eddie Hsu also.
Yeah.
I really loved jazz at that time, and of course, I still do. And the blues, has always came just as natural to me as just talking to you right now. It's just a part of me that I just can't shake. I have no desire to shake. It's just as natural as it can be.
Well, you got a couple new albums out. One called Shockabilly.
Yeah, Shockabilly was produced by a guy in Cape Girardeau, Missouri, that I've known for years and years. His name is Lou Hobbs, and Lou had a country hit in Billboard and Cashbox. I think it was "Somebody Shoot the Jukebox." Believe it or not, I think that's the name of it. But but Lou had an awful lot of hits in Europe on the Hot Disc label, and a very nice person that we've known for years and years. In fact, he used to follow Norval Feltz and myself around and help us unload the stuff out of the cars, and he was too young to get into the nightclub. Actually, I guess I shouldn't really call them nightclubs because, man, they were rough juke joint honky-tonks. They were really bad.
Do you remember any in particular?
Well, yeah, the one that stands out in my mind would be probably Lepanto, Arkansas, the Starlight Club. You would never know if you would even get in the club without getting your teeth knocked out. The women, and that's the women fighting each other. The women were, it was like a John Wayne movie, man. They're throwing chairs at each other. And this place, the bandstand was in the back of this long building, and they had an exhaust fan because naturally everybody smoked about four packs of cigarettes a night. And in this honky-tonk, and this fan was behind the bandstand. So the fan would come on. All the smoke from every drunk in this bar, plus all the odors, everything would come right across you, you know, and be sucked out. This fan looked like a prop jet fan. This thing was huge, man. It must have been like a six-foot fan.
In reverse, right?
Yeah, I thought it was going to suck us into the fan. Because I remember seeing a movie once with... I think it was Peter Lorre, and I think, if I remember correctly, he tied someone to an aircraft propeller and spun it around, and the guy died of high blood pressure.
Oh, my God.
But anyway, that sticks out in my mind, and, of course, the fights. That place in Lepanto, I was talking to my friend Charlie Musselwhite, and he remembered that place, too. It was a pretty deadly place.
I'm glad you told me about that. Remind me not to go there.
Avoid Lepanto, Arkansas.
Lepanto, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after you had I'm Moving On,
yeah,
you went back in the studio and recorded, was it Ooby Dooby?
Yeah, Ooby Dooby was the next one. That was also Norval and the JW and myself on drums. And I love to improvise. It's very, very difficult for me not to improvise. That's probably from my background in jazz, I guess. I just love to not repeat myself.
Yeah.
I'm the same way even playing drums. I just, not that I get away from the beat, but I mean, if I do drum solos, I admire drummers like Max Roach and Art Blakey and Buddy Rich and Louis Belson and Shelly Mann, of course, was great, and Chico Hamilton, these people, because their left foot was always consistent with the beat, but their hands were so independent. They're very creative people, and I always tried to be that way. And so I just tried to constantly improvise. But I got in the studio, and Roland James was at his studio also. And he said, Matt, do you know that song Ooby Dooby? I said, yeah, because I played drums with Roy Orbison. And I like Roy's version of the song. And he said, well, why don't you try to, you know, jam it, make it up? So I said, okay. So I took a couple of cuts on it, and I started off like, let's see, what did I do? I said, hey, baby, this is Matt Lucas. Come on out on this dance floor. I'm going to tell you about something brand new. I made it up, baby. It's called a Ooby Dooby, and I'm doing it just for you. Now, here's how it goes. Then I went into the drum beat, that beat that I think a lot of people have said, Matt, when you play drums, you got that Matt Lucas beat, and I can tell it's you on the drums. And a lot of other drummers have told me that also, which I'm complimented by. And so we took two or three cuts on that Ooby Dooby. And away it went. It went right out on Smash Records, a division of Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
And the record took off sort of like I'm Moving On. I had a lot of trouble getting I'm Moving On played when it was on Rene Records because at the time, this was, like I say, 1962, and in Memphis, people told me, Matt, you sound too black, and we can't play that kind of music on our radio station.
Ain't that something?
And I got so tired of hearing that, man, that I went out to a fantastic radio station that was known as the Voice of the American Negro, and it was WDIA mm-hmm. in Memphis. And B.B. King was a disc jockey there, and Nat D., and Martha Jean the Queen, whom
That's
you remember
right.
from Detroit.
Absolutely.
And Rufus Thomas, and all those guys. So I took it to Rufus. And Rufus said, tell me something. Matt says, boy, he says, how come your own people won't play this record? And I said, well, Rufus, I ain't going to lie to you. They told me that I sounded too colored. And they told me something a little bit different than that. But anyway, Rufus played the record, and he says, Matt, baby, you do.
You do.
You do. And he said, you're going to have a hit record because I'm going to play it. Everyone at the station is going to play it. And so that 50,000-watt a radio station got on that record, and then the other black radio station, I can't recall the call letters right now, but it was right down on Beale Street, and the disc jockey's name was Nat Kane Cole. Not King Cole, but Nat Kane
Cole.
Cole got on it, and the record sold so many copies from the black airplay that it was on the charts of the white radio stations like WHBQ in Memphis, which was, I think it was a Plow and RKO station. But anyway, George Klein was program director, my buddy from a long, long time ago. He was Elvis Presley's best buddy also.
Yeah.
In fact, he's still in Memphis. But anyway, then they had to play the record because the record was on their charts.
Yeah.
It was on the sales charts. So
WLAC play the record?
Oh, man. Hey, Rufus says, man, he says, I want you to go over, Matt. He says, you got any money? I said, well, I can get to Nashville. He said, well, that's where I want you to go. I said, I want you to go over and see my buddy, John R., John Richburg.
That's right.
WLAC. I said, well, man, I'm going to go give it a shot. So I got in my little Renault car, and I had, I think, a credit card and maybe about $75. And at that time, this little Renault Caravelle car that I had, you couldn't get parts for that thing anywhere, man. And I had three different size tires on it. And I wobbled all the way from Memphis to Nashville, and I got over there, and the tallest building in Nashville was the Life and Casualty Insurance Building.
That's right.
And that's where John R. and Hoss Allen, Gene Nobles from Randy's Record Shop, Herman Gazzard, Buckley's Record Store. They were all there, and I went in. I think maybe the guy that ran the elevator, the old security guard, must have been about 90 years old.
Yep.
He said, "Boy, what do you want?" I said, "Rufus Thomas sent me over here to call John R. or to meet Mr. John R." And he said, "Just a minute." And he called upstairs. Next thing I know, man, I'm in the elevator with my records, and there I go. And the studio seemed like it was a block long. Of course, it wasn't. But John R. sitting back here with the headphones on, "Come here, boy." So I went back there, and he shook my hand. He played the record, and he says, "Matt Lucas, you got a hit, baby." Now, bear in mind, this was still on that little label, Rene Records. And he says, "Have you ever been to Atlanta?" I said, "Nope." He says, "Boy, you got to go to Atlanta and talk to my buddies over there at WAOK.
Zena Sears."
That's it. So I got in the car, wobbled my way to Atlanta. And early in the morning, I got there. I drove all night. Early in the morning, I got there. The radio station was locked up, but it was on the air. And I knocked on the door. The janitor came, said, "What do you want?" I said, "Well, John R. told me to come over and see Zena Sears." And he took off for a couple of minutes, and he went back and talked to a disc jockey that was on the air. His name was Bob McKee.
Bob McKee.
And so they opened the door, let me in, introduced me to Piano Red. And then with Bob McKee, and Bob McKee set me down, played the record. This all-black radio station, playing all-black music. And at that time, the disc jockeys were playing their own records. They had a turntable on the right, a turntable on the left. And so Bob McKee played the record once. He says, "Man, Matt Baby, you got a hit." After he played it, it was on the right-hand turntable. Then he put it on the left and started right off again. After playing it about three times in a row, the phone started lighting up in the studio. And then Zena Sears came in, and the man introduced me to Zena Sears, and he said, "There's someone else I want you to meet, Matt, since you're over here." I was thrilled to have met Piano Red, you know.
Yeah.
That was a shocker. But here comes this cat in with Zena Sears, and he said, "Matt," he said, "I want to introduce you to my friend that I manage, the King of the Stroll, Chuck Willis. Yeah, so, man, I was flipping out.
You were in heaven.
Yeah, I was in fool's paradise.
Oh,
so,
man.
It even gets better, because as Bob McKee was playing this record, he says, "This little label, Rene, says, man, you're going to have a hit record. You need to be on a major label." And he picked up the phone, and he called Charlie Fash at Mercury Records. And Mercury had a label called Smash. It was a fairly new label at the time. And Charlie Fash asked him over the phone, you know, who had the master and where did he cut it and what's this boy look like and everything. And so the next thing I know, I was on Mercury. I was on Smash Records. And I'm sitting in Elvis's dentist chair with the smoke pouring out of my mouth, getting my teeth capped. And, man, instead of working the dives with Norville over in Arkansas and Southern Illinois and Southern Missouri, I'm taking a little leave of absence and getting on a plane and flying into Louisville and flying back to Nashville and flying into Detroit. I flew into Detroit, and of course that's where I met you.
Yeah.
And but I also met Ollie McLaughlin there, but I'm sure we'll talk about that in a minute.
We will.
And the record was number one in Detroit on the black stations and the white stations, so I was flipping out.
So you had WQXI, WPLO.
Right.
Right. WAOK.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Burke Johnson was playing it. Everybody was playing it.
Yeah, it was just, I was in paradise.
Heaven, man.
Oh, man, there's nothing like it. You can imagine a dummy like me, man, driving in my car, and when you hear your record played on,
feeling.
Yeah, in WHBQ or WLS in Chicago with Dick Biondi.
That's right.
Man, I want to wreck my car. It's the first time I heard bop, bop, a loop, bop. Man, I want to drive into a cotton patch. I was flipping out.
Well, why don't we play Ooby Dooby now?
Okay.
All right? Play Ooby Dooby now, and then we'll get back to the conversation.
All right.
Hold on.
Hey, baby. This is Matt Lucas. Come on out here on this dance floor. I'm going to tell you about a new dance that's real easy to do. I made it up. It's called a Ooby Dooby, honey, and I'm doing it just for you. Now, Now here's how you do it, baby. I say, help me to jump over here when you do the oobie doobie. I just got to be in the oobie doobie. Woo, oobie doobie. Ooh, the doobie 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 doobie. Wiggle to the left and you wiggle to the right and you do the oobie doobie with all of your mind. Now oobie doobie. Woo, oobie doobie. Ooh, la doodle doodle. Time. Oh, listen to my beat. Come on, baby. Work your feet. Woo! Well, you wiggle and shake like a big rattlesnake. And you do the ooby doo do till you think I don't think I'm ooby doo. Woo! Ooby doo. Ooby doo, 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 you've been studying, honey, now I know that you can do the ooby-dooby. So come on, let's go, ooby-dooby-doo. Woo, ooby-dooby. Ooby-dooby-dooby-dooby-dooby-dooby-doo. Wild, 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 wild.
Back together now with Mr. Matt Lukas. That was Ooby Dooby, right? And that was on Smash.
Yeah.
And
my second record on Smash, and I had trouble with that record too, although I just come off that super hit. That I'm Moving On was a worldwide hit record for me,
yeah.
John. You know that.
Yeah.
And man, I was I just couldn't believe it. And so Ooby Dooby started off big, big hit in the South, but then it started having trouble getting it played. People said, same thing again.
Same thing
Matt,
again.
Too wild and crazy. And, you know, it's just too wild to play, you know, when they're playing songs like, I don't know, Puff the Magic Dragon,
that was a folk
Sukiyaki,
era.
Sukiyaki,
right?
You know.
Yeah, right. It was a folk era was starting then.
Yeah.
Right?
And then, of course, the Beatles were coming in a little bit
later.
You know, John, I forgot to tell you, here we are in L.A., or almost in L.A., out in the valley here. And about 50 years ago, I came out here.
You were actually out here?
Yeah, I was living here in L.A., man. I drove my 1937 Plymouth out here with a couple of buddies in it with my leopard skin seat covers. And I drove all the way through L.A. and went all the way to the ocean to look at the Pacific. Then I got back in that old 37 Plymouth, and I got back I seen the sign, Beverly Hills. I thought, man. And then, you know, when you're young, how you dream, how you believe everything you read, like the magazines, like Modern Screen. Hey, man, I want to be Matt the Movie Star. Well, I look on the left-hand side coming down Sunset, and there was the original Brown Derby. I think it was on Sunset. It must have been.
Yeah.
And I looked at that building, and, man, I drove a couple blocks down the street and parked that 37 Plymouth. I'd been up for 3 days, and I think I was 19, and I went up to that place, and the windows in the Brown Derby had windows that looked like portholes on a ship.
Yeah.
And I looked in there, man, who did I see? Bette Davis.
Oh, my God.
Sitting at a table. And I thought, man, I'm such a lucky guy with the chicks. When Bette Davis comes out, I couldn't afford to go in because I didn't have much money. And when she comes out, I'll hit on her, and who knows? I think Bette Davis just might get me in the movie. So I'm waiting on Miss Davis to come out. And here comes this policeman on a Harley-Davidson three-wheel service cycle. He's got this long stick with a piece of chalk on it, and he's marking the tires on the automobiles because they didn't have parking meters. This guy with the mark on his tire, he could tell how long a car has been parked there. So when he came up to me, he got off his motorcycle. He said, son, where are you from? I said, well, I was born in Memphis, but I came out here from Papa Bluff, Missouri. And he said, does your folks know you're out here? I said, yeah. I said, I came out here to get in the movies. Man, he thought he had a nutcase on his hand. Well, he had me roll up my sleeves. He wanted to see my draft card, of course, which I showed him. He had me roll up my sleeves. He's looking for needle marks. And about that time, here comes a plain Jane police car, unmarked police car with two detectives in it. So they come over and they put me in the car, and they asked me the same story, and I told them, and they wanted to know where my car was parked, and I told them. So we went down, and my two friends were sleeping in the car in Beverly Hills. They took us all down to the Beverly Hills police station, which had wall-to-wall carpet. We went inside, and they called Troop E of the Butler County, Missouri Highway Patrol, got in touch with my father, to find out if
it was okay.
Yeah.
Right?
So he said, yeah. He said, that crazy son, he's out there trying to get in the movies. They told me, boy, get out of Beverly Hills, get back into L.A. with the rest of the riffraff, and never come back to Beverly Hills.
I'll be damned. Welcome to Hollywood, right?
That's it.
And what did you do? How long were you out here?
Oh, I'm out here off and on from like 1953 to 57, in and out. Like I was here maybe 14 to 15 months the first time. And it's funny, I can remember going down Hollywood Boulevard to buy a record. I wanted to buy a record by the Spiders called You're the One.
You're the One.
I love that song.
So Chuck Carbo.
Right. And I went in. I says, man, I want to buy that record. He said, would you like to have it on 78 or 45? I said, what is a 45?
What's a 45?
And he showed me the 45. And I said, well, man, you know, how do you play it? He said, well, you just got this little spindle you put on your thing, you know, and he had an RCA or a Philips.
Yeah, one of the one they used to give away.
And I said, hey, man, no, just give me a 78. I want more for my money. So I got that, and that was my first experience with the 45. But that was an exciting time in Los Angeles, man. Here I'm a kid. Hollywood was still alive, barely. They were making a little bit later on Rock Around the Clock out at Metro and Culver City out Washington Boulevard. And the studios, they still had part of the Star studio system, so,
yeah.
So I had the stars in my eyes. But I'd met a guy at a party, a show business party, and I was playing conga drum, and we would play private parties, and some of the parties were pretty wild. I was at a party one night, and James Dean was at that party over in the corner with a guy.
Yeah.
And, of course, I really didn't know who James Dean was at the time. But there were people there, like people were there from Fantasy Records,
mm-hmm.
Pacific Jazz, Chet Baker, a very famous photographer who's probably still around. He's got to be getting pretty old. But William Claxton used to do all the covers for the jazz.
Yeah.
In fact, he probably did all kinds of LP covers. But in fact, they invited me out to Capitol Records, the Capitol Tower. So I went out there, and I met guys like Shelly Mann, who I loved as a drummer, Leroy Vinegar, Hampton Halls, Jerry Mulligan, Bud Shank, Shorty Rogers. These guys were just, you know, geniuses. And
yeah.
I loved L.A. I just loved everything about it. And in fact, I was so dumb. The very first place I lived in L.A., man, was down on Main Street, not far from the old bus station down on Skid Row. And I thought, man, here I am in Hollywood, and my room is only $9 a week. And I thought, but boy, it's a noisy place, because I was hearing screams and everything. Man, people were getting chopped up. You know, it was a rough neighborhood. And that's how dumb I was, you know, when I came out here. But some of the acts that were really big at that time, like I say, the Dick Hugg down at Vernon and Central here in L.A.
Huggy Boy?
Yeah, Huggy Boy. He used to...
He's still on the air out here.
Yeah. And... well, let's see, like, oh, my goodness, Clyde McFatter, I think at that time, had Money Honey, I think, unless it was Honey Love, and Shake a Hand by the two gals, Faye Adams, and someone else had Shake a Hand.
Loretta Dillard.
That's it. And those records were so, and the Clovers. Oh my, the Clovers just tore me up.
Clovers were great, weren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, that was they were doing. Let's see, the Clovers. Golly.
Well, one minute, Julep, Lovey Dovey,
right.
Little Mama.
Lovey Dovey, Little Mama, my favorite.
Oh, I love Little Mama.
Little Mama was like one of the sexiest records ever made.
Oh, man, that group was so cool.
That's Jerry Wexler, Atlantic.
I tell you, let me tell you, man, I always wanted to be on Atlantic Records.
Greatest label.
Always. I never heard a bad, I'm sure there was mediocre Atlantic Records, but I never heard them because I guess they didn't get played.
No.
And I always wanted to be on that label. I came pretty close once with my friend in Detroit, Ollie McLaughlin.
Yeah, absolutely. Ollie, what a great guy.
But boy, I loved L.A. Such an exciting place. I still love L.A.
L.A. is a great town.
Yeah.
It's still a happening town.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we're going to sign off for this first half of the Blue Power Hour with Mr. Matt Lucas, and we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. Click on part 2.